Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the NYU Migration Network's 15-minute explainers on aspects of U.S. immigration policy. My name is Natasha Iskander. I'm a professor at NYU Wagner School of Public Service, and I am the director of the NYU Migration Network, a network of NYU faculty and researchers who work on questions of migration and mobility. This fall, we're hosting an event series to explore the implications of using enforcement as a core vector of immigration policy, with an emphasis, unfortunately, on detention and deportation. I say unfortunately because this is obviously not an area that we would like to see as a necessary area of so much policy attention. As part of this series, we're offering a set of short explainers that cover some of the key policy concepts involved in detention and deportation practice. You can find the recordings of today's explainer and past explainers on the NYU Migration Network website for you to return to and share. That address is migration.nyu.edu. Again, migration.nyu.edu. Today, on behalf of the network, I'm delighted to introduce you to Dominic Vitello, professor of city planning and urban studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And he will tell us a little bit about sanctuary cities. Dominic is an urban historian and planner whose research, teaching, and practice focus on community development in migrant communities, on urban agriculture, and on urban history. His award-winning book, The Sanctuary City, Immigrant, Refugee, and Receiving Communities in Post-Industrial Philadelphia, compares the experiences of people from Central America, Southeast Asia, West Africa, Southwest Asia, and Mexico as they arrive and settle in the city of brotherly love. You can find the links to these, to Dominic's research and teaching in the chat, as well as the link to his book, which is open source and you can download it at no cost. Welcome, Dominic. It's really great to have you. I'm so excited to be able to talk with you and learn more about sanctuary cities. You've written extensively about sanctuary cities, and in particular, your book is a powerful explainer on the topic of today, sanctuary city. Can you tell us what a sanctuary city is, and can you tell us what it is not?
Well, first of all, Natasha, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm glad to talk with you today and with your guests. At the most basic level, what we call a sanctuary city in the United States today is a place, a city or a county or sometimes a state that does not cooperate with the federal government in detention and deportation activities around immigration enforcement. And today that means non-cooperation with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement agency, ICE. Sometimes we talk about a sanctuary city as a city government, or again, another local government that offers other sorts of support for vulnerable immigrants, for vulnerable newcomers, sometimes in the form of legal defense, including in immigration proceedings, and sometimes other forms of support. And so part of what you hear in that definition is that there's no real one agreement about what a sanctuary city means, but at the core, it means non-cooperation in detention and deportation activities. I think it's important to also, you know, emphasize, as you said, what a sanctuary city is not. It does not mean active protection and prevention of federal detention and deportation activities in a city or a town. That would be illegal. It would be unconstitutional. And so it's important to recognize that for cities or other local or state governments that have sanctuary policies, it's a passive stance. It's not an active protection that's preventing the federal government from doing its immigration enforcement work in any space within the United States.
That's a really important distinction. Thank you for flagging us the fact that it's a passive stance and a non-cooperation with immigration enforcement. In your book, you help us understand that even this passive stance comes from a long history of activism. and that there's a history to sanctuary cities, a history that gives rise to them in their current form. Can you tell us about this history? Can you tell us how and why the idea of sanctuary cities emerged?
Yes, gladly. And this is a very long history. If your listeners know the Bible, they may recognize that there are traditions of sanctuary cities, sanctuary places, in ancient Hebrew times, in ancient Hebrew societies, where God tells Moses to designate the city of the cities of sanctuary, tells the Israelites, right? And there are other ancient societies, ancient Hawaiian society, ancient South Asian Indian, and other European and non-European societies that had traditions of sanctuary places. Sometimes those were towns or cities. Sometimes it was a temple or a church, ultimately. And in ancient and medieval times, sanctuary and sanctuary spaces were mainly for protecting soldiers who were on the losing sides of battles or wars, or other people who had been accused of involuntary manslaughter. Now, fast forward a fair bit to more early modern times, and we have lots of important episodes of sanctuary and sanctuary places, sometimes cities or towns, sometimes religious spaces, oftentimes, right, that are harboring people for one reason or another. That has to do with some sort of disagreement about who deserves protection. And in some senses, that's fundamental to sanctuary. It's a contested form of protection, whether given by a group of people in a religious congregation or by a city or other local government. Some of those really important episodes of history, I think, include the Underground Railroad, supporting people escaping slavery. Also at the same time in the years before the American Civil War, certain cities and towns refused to abide by the Federal Fugitive Slave Act and refused to return people who had escaped slavery to their would-be owners in the South. To me, that's a very clear precedent for what we call sanctuary cities. Looking at Europe in the 20th century, there are plenty of towns across France, Italy, Spain, other places that hide Jewish people, right, and harbor them from the Nazis, fascists, also during the Spanish Civil War. So all of these are different sort of episodes of sanctuary in our longer histories around the world. But the contemporary meaning of sanctuary cities as places offering, again, that sort of passive, contested protection and support for immigrants and refugees or would-be refugees really dates to the end of the 1970s in the United States, when in 1979, the sheriff of Los Angeles issues an executive order saying no local officials, including police and prison officials, can ask people about their citizenship or immigration status. We will, in that way, not participate in federal detention and deportation activities. And by the mid-1980s, a whole number of cities, a couple dozen cities by about 1986, 87, had passed resolutions or ordinances that either referenced sanctuary or they were often called city of refuge resolutions, which means the same thing. San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago, New York, also smaller places, college towns like Ithaca, New York, or Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, or Ann Arbor, Michigan, Berkeley, California, and a couple of sanctuary states, New Mexico and Wisconsin, all in the 1980s, provided this same sort of non-cooperation, again, passive protection for people. And this was during a particular era of our immigration history, during in the 1980s, what we call the sanctuary movement, when people across Mexico, the United States, and Canada organized to help people from Central America, especially from Guatemala and El Salvador, flee what was U.S.-backed genocide in the civil wars going on in those countries. And the sanctuary movement is often called an underground railroad, helping people get to safety, and a very small number of people from Central America. We're hosted in congregations across the United States, about 300 or 400 people at the height of that in the mid-1980s. Some colleges and seminaries in the 1980s also declared themselves sanctuary campuses, places that Central Americans who were seeking asylum but being denied asylum could find some safety and support. And that's really how we got, if you will, the modern era of sanctuary cities. The sanctuary movement ended in the 1990s in many ways as the Central American Civil Wars ended. And so that era of our history is in many ways past. But in the 21st century, many cities have established or reaffirmed their sanctuary policies and their sanctuary stances. And so much of it goes back before our immigration debates blew up in the 21st century, after September 11th, 2001, or in 2005 and 2006. Really, it goes back to our 1996 Immigration Act, which expanded local law enforcement collaboration in detention and deportation, largely through the 287G clause in that 1996 Act. And that, in turn, inspired a various forms of sort of pushback, including sanctuary city policies that were enacted in the early 2000s. And then, as U.S. immigration debates heated up in the last 20 years or so, including with the election and re-election of Donald Trump to the White House, more and more cities have, and counties and states, again, have reaffirmed their sanctuary positions and policies and defended them in court against the Trump administration as well. And also sanctuary activism, sometimes similar to the 1980s, but also much broader immigrant rights activism that we associate with sanctuary today has again really boomed in the 21st century, first around 2006, 2007, and then again after Donald Trump was elected for the first time in 2016. So that's a bit of a long history, but that brings us up very much to the contemporary era of sanctuary cities today.
That's an extremely helpful history to help us understand that this arrangement, this commitment to passive engagement with kind of federal immigration policy, or passive disengagement rather, has a long political and institutional history, which brings us to the current moment where all of a sudden sanctuary cities are in the news everywhere. The Trump administration has made them the target of directed immigration enforcement in a very explicit and intentional way, even punitive way. So it makes me wonder about sanctuary cities in this contemporary moment. In particular, your work talks about the way that sanctuary cities shape the relationship between migration, migrants, and urban space. Can you tell us more about how that relationship is playing out given these, you know, political headwinds, given the way that the Trump administration considers sanctuary cities and acts towards sanctuary cities?
Yeah, well, I think it's fair to say that sanctuary has always been pretty fundamentally about working to create safe spaces for vulnerable people in one form or another, for people who need some sort of protection and assistance as they're targeted by unjust policies or systems or authorities or ones that people find unjust. And I think it's important to recognize that spaces of sanctuary exist sometimes more concretely and sometimes more abstractly, but in very concrete terms, not just in the confines of a city or a political jurisdiction, but people give one another safety and find safety, right, in people's homes, in workplaces. I've mentioned congregations and schools and college campuses and really other spaces of everyday life, right, where really we're talking about sanctuary movements and people offering one another a safe space where they're not going to report on one another and going to keep each other safe. And that's oftentimes a more active and concrete form of mutual protection than, say, the passive stance of a city or state government. Now, it's also important to recognize that the U.S. government and other nations and empires and armies have often treated certain spaces as off limits, especially places of worship and other religious institutions, right, where authorities will not go in and remove people. Some of that speaks to the United States' constitutional separation of church and state. So it's especially about places of worship, but also schools, hospitals, courts. Sometimes other spaces like Native American tribal lands have been off limits to immigration enforcement. But the Trump administration this year has removed most of those sorts of restrictions, particularly on schools, hospitals, courts. And today, right, with the administration's quite aggressive deportation efforts, and also with really tightening pathways to asylum and other legal statuses in the United States and also most of Europe and many other places around the world. And today also as more people are displaced and seeking safety in our country and around the world today, right? More than ever before in history, I think it's important to recognize that sanctuary matters to more people than ever in all sorts of spaces.
Dominic, this is a really helpful kind of overview of what a sanctuary city is, how it came to be, and what it is in this particular moment. I want to ask, is there anything else that you would like to leave us with as we continue to explore this concept of sanctuary cities?
Sure. A couple of things. And it's probably evident from some of my remarks that, first of all, sanctuary has been a fluid and malleable concept. Sometimes people see it as an aspiration, but also as a set of practices that take many different forms. And as sanctuary activists in the 1980s recognized, and this is a quote from people, at different times and places under varied circumstances, the significance of sanctuary has been recovered and taken on new meanings. And that's the end of the quote. I hope my little history lesson has helped people appreciate some of those different meanings and different episodes. And so historically, right, as well as today, sanctuary also means different things for different people who are fleeing different situations or seeking different sorts of protection and assistance. But it's also important, and this is the second and last thing I'll note, right, that sanctuary at its core is really about seeing ourselves and our neighbors, right, the people whom we're connected to locally and globally through migration, as one humanity, right, all as human beings worthy of rights and freedoms that we would all like to enjoy. And sanctuary is in many ways about taking steps to ensure that we all can enjoy those rights and freedoms in a very broad sense, seeing one another as one humanity again. Thank you very much for having me on today, Natasha.
Thank you, Dominic. That is such a powerful and important note to end on. Thank you for reminding us of the core principle of sanctuary and the ways that it manifests in our sanctuary cities, of which New York is one. With that, I'll turn it over to Harlow, who will introduce the series and some of Dominic's work.
Thank you so much, Natasha and Dominic, for this amazing discussion. And thank you to all of us who are able to join us today. For recordings of past explainers, we will have them on our website. It's migration.nyu.edu. I'm also putting it into the chat. And while this ends our virtual explainers, we will also have one more online discussion on November 12th, our global comparisons panel. The link to register is in the chat as well, and it will be 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. We hope to see you all there. And I will leave the Zoom up for 5 more minutes for collections of links and registration. And thank you again for joining us and to our speakers for joining us today.